Chapter 34. The Wheel Weaves. The first light of morning already pearled the sky by the time Tom Marilyn found himself trudging back to the bunch of grapes. Even where the halls and taverns lay thickest, there was a brief time when the foregate lay quiet, gathering its breath. In his present mood, Tom would not have noticed if the empty street had been on fire. Some of Barthanas's guests had insisted on keeping him long after most had gone, long after Barthanas had taken himself to bed. It had been his own fault for leaving the great hunt of the horn, changing to the sort of tales he told and songs he sang in the villages. Mara and the Three Foolish Kings, and How Susa Tamed Jaen Farstrider, and Stories of Anla the Wise Counselor. He had meant the choices to be a private comment on their stupidity, never dreaming any of them might listen, much less be intrigued. Intrigued in a way. They had demanded more of the same, but they had laughed in the wrong places, at the wrong things. They had laughed at him, too, apparently thinking he would not notice, or else that a full purse stuffed in his pocket would heal any wounds. He had almost thrown it away twice already. The heavy purse burning his pocket and pride was not the only reason for his mood, nor even the noble's contempt. They had asked questions about Rand, not even bothering to be subtle with a mere gleeman. Why was Rand in Kyrian? Why had an Andoran lord taken him, a gleeman, aside? Too many questions. He was not sure his answers had been clever enough. His reflexes for the great game were rusty. Before turning toward the bunch of grapes, he had gone to the great tree. It was not difficult to find where someone was staying in Kyrian if you pressed a palm or two with silver. He was still not sure what he had intended to say. Rand was gone with his friends and the Aes Sedai. It left a feeling of something not done. The boy's on his own now. Burn me, I'm out of it. He strode through the common room, empty as it seldom was, and took the steps two at a time. At least he tried to. His right leg did not bend well, and he nearly fell. Muttering to himself, he climbed the rest of the way at a slower pace and opened the door to his room softly, so as not to wake Dina. Despite himself, he smiled when he saw her lying on the bed with her face turned to the wall, still in her dress. Fell asleep waiting for me, fool girl. But it was a kindly thought. He was not sure there was anything she would do that he would not forgive or excuse. Deciding on the spur of the moment that tonight was the night he'd let her perform for the first time, he lowered his harp case to the floor and put a hand on her shoulder to wake her and tell her. She rolled limply onto her back, staring up at him, glazed eyes open wide above the gash across her throat. The side of the bed that had been hidden by her body was dark and sodden. Tom's stomach heaved. If his throat had not been so tight he could not breathe, he would have vomited or screamed or both. He had only the creaking of wardrobe doors for warning. He spun, knives coming out of his sleeves, leaving his hands in the same motion. The first blade took the throat of a fat, balding man with a dagger in his hand. The man stumbled back, blood bubbling around his clutching fingers as he tried to cry out. Spinning on his bad leg threw Tom's other blade off, though. The knife stuck in the right shoulder of a heavily muscled man with scars on his face, who was climbing out of the other wardrobe. The big man's knife dropped from a hand that suddenly would not do what he wanted, and he lumbered for the door. Before he could take a second step, Tom produced another knife and slashed him across the back of his leg. The big man yelled and stumbled, and Tom seized a handful of greasy hair, slamming his face against the wall beside the door. The man screamed again as the knife hilt sticking out of his shoulder hit the door. Tom thrust the blade in his hand to within an inch of the man's dark eye. The scars in the big man's face gave him a hard look. But he stared at the point without blinking and did not move a muscle. The fat man, lying half in the wardrobe, kicked a last kick and was still.
"Before I kill you," Tom said, "tell me, why?"
His voice was quiet, numb. He felt numb inside.
"The great game," the man said quickly.
His accent was of the streets and his clothes as well, but they were a shade too fine, too unworn. He had more coin to spend than any foregater should.
"Nothing against you personally, you see. It is just the game."
"The game. I'm not mixed up in Deus Dimar. Who would want to kill me for the great game?"
The man hesitated, Tom moved his blade closer. If the fellow blinked, his eyelashes would brush the point.
Who?
Barthanas,
came the hoarse answer.
Lord Barthanas, we would not have killed you. Barthanas wants information. We just wanted to find out what you know. There can be gold in it for you. A nice, fat, golden crown for what you know. Maybe two.
Liar!
I was in Barthanas' manor last night, as close to him as I am to you. If he wanted anything of me, I'd never have left alive.
I tell you, we have been looking for you, or anyone who knows about this Andoran lord, for days. I never heard your name until last night downstairs. Lord Barthanas is generous. It could be 5 crowns.
The man tried to pull his head away from the knife in Tom's hand, and Tom pushed him harder against the wall.
What Andoran lord?
But he knew. The light helped him, he knew.
Rand, of House Althor. Tall, young, a blade master, or at least he wears the sword. I know he came to see you. Him and an ogier, and you talked. Tell me what you know. I might even throw in a crown or two myself.
You fool,
Tom breathed. Dina died for this.
Oh, light, she's dead.
He felt as if he wanted to cry.
The boy's a shepherd.
A shepherd in a fancy coat with Aes Sedai around him like bees around honey roses.
Just a shepherd.
He tightened his grip in the man's hair.
Wait, wait! You can make more than any 5 crowns, or even 10. 100 more like. Every house wants to know about this Randall Thor. 2 or 3 have approached me. With what you know and my knowing who wants to know it, we could both fill our pockets. And there has been a woman, a lady, I have seen more than once while asking after him. If we can find out who she is, why, we could sell that too.
You've made one real mistake in it all, Tom said.
Mistake?
The man's far hand was beginning to slide down toward his belt. No doubt he had another dagger there. Tom ignored it.
You should never have touched the girl.
The man's hand darted for his belt, then he gave one convulsive start as Tom's knife went home. Tom let him fall over away from the door and stood a moment before bending tiredly to tug his blades free. The door banged open, and he whirled with a snarl on his face. Zara jerked back, a hand to her throat, staring at him.
That fool Ella just told me, she said unsteadily. The 2 of Barthanas' men were asking after you last night, and with what I've heard this morning, I thought you said you didn't play in the game anymore.
They found me, he said wearily.
Her eyes dropped from his face and widened as they took in the bodies of the 2 men. Hastily, she stepped into the room, shutting the door behind her.
This is bad, Tom. You'll have to leave Cairhien.
Her gaze fell on the bed, and her breath caught.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Oh, Tom, I'm so sorry.
I cannot leave yet, Zara.
He hesitated, then tenderly drew a blanket over Dina, covering her face.
I have another man to kill first.
The innkeeper gave herself a shake and pulled her eyes away from the bed. Her voice was more than a little breathy.
If you mean Barthanas, you're too late. Everybody's talking about it already. He is dead. His servants found him this morning, torn to pieces in his bedchamber. The only way they knew it was him was his head stuck on a spike over the fireplace.
She laid a hand on his arm.
Tom, you can't hide that you were there last night. Not from anybody who wants to know. Add these 2 in, and there's nobody in Cairhien who won't believe you're involved.
There was a slight questioning note in her last words, as if she too were wondering.
It doesn't matter, I suppose, he said dully.
He could not stop looking down at the blanket-covered shape on the bed.
Perhaps I will go back to Andor, to Caemlyn.
She shook his shoulders, turning him away from the bed.
You men,
she sighed.
Always thinking with either your muscles or your hearts, and never your heads. Caemlyn is as bad as Cairhien for you. Either place you'll end up dead or in prison. Do you think she'd want that? If you want to honor her memory, stay alive.
Will you take care of... He could not say it.
Growing old, he thought, growing soft. He pulled the heavy purse from his pocket and folded her hands around it.
We should take care of everything. And help when they start asking questions about me, too.
I will see to everything, she said gently. You must go, Tom. Now.
He nodded reluctantly and slowly began stuffing a few things in a set of saddlebags. While he worked, Zara got her first close look at the fat man sprawled partway in the wardrobe, and she gave a loud gasp. He looked at her inquiringly. As long as he had known her, she had never been one to faint over blood.
These aren't Barthanas's men, Tom. At least that one isn't.
She nodded toward the fat man.
It's the worst-kept secret in Kyrian that he works for House Riotan. For Galdrian.
Galdrian, he said flatly. What has that bloody shepherd gotten me into?
What have the Aes Sedai gotten us both into?
But it was Galdrian's men murdered her.
There must have been something of his thoughts on his face. Zara said sharply,
Dina wants you alive, you fool. You try to kill the king, and you'll be dead before you get within 100 spans of him, if you come that close.
A roar came from within the city walls, as if half of Kyrian were shouting. Frowning, Tom peered from his window. Beyond the top of the gray walls, above the rooftops of the foregate, a thick column of smoke was rising into the sky, far beyond the walls. Beside the first black pillar, a few gray tendrils quickly grew into another, and more wisps appeared further on. He estimated the distance and took a deep breath.
Perhaps you had better think of leaving, too. It looks as if someone is firing the granaries.
I have lived through riots before. Go now, Tom.
With a last look at Dina's shrouded form, he gathered his things, but as he started to leave, Zara spoke again.
You have a dangerous look in your eyes, Tom Merrillin. Imagine Dina sitting here, alive and hale. Think what she would say.
Would she let you go off and get yourself killed to no purpose?
I am only an old gleeman, he said from the door. And Randolph Thor is only a shepherd, but we both do what we must. Who could I possibly be dangerous to?
As he pulled the door to, hiding her, hiding Dina, a mirthless, wolfish grin came onto his face. His leg hurt, but he barely felt it as he turned purposely down the stairs and out of the inn. Padan Fain reined in his horse atop a hill above Falma, in one of the few sparse thickets remaining on the hills outside the town. The pack horse bearing his precious burden bumped his leg, and he kicked it in the ribs without looking. The animal snorted and jerked back to the end of the lead he had tied to his saddle. The woman had not wanted to give up her horse, no more than any of the dark friends who had followed him had wanted to be left alone, in the hills with the Trollocs, without Fane's protecting presence. He had solved both problems easily. Meat in a Trolloc cookpot had no need of a horse. The woman's companions had been shaken by the journey along the ways, to a waygate outside a long-abandoned steading on Toman Head. And watching the Trollocs prepare their dinner had made the surviving dark friends extremely biddable. From the edge of the trees, Fane studied the unwalled town and sneered. One short merchant train was rumbling in among the stables and horse lots and wagon yards that bordered the town, while another rumbled out, raising little dust from dirt packed by many years of such traffic. The men driving the wagons and the few riding beside them were all local men by their clothing, yet the mounted men at least had swords on baldricks, and even a few spears and bows. The soldiers he saw, and there were few, did not seem to be watching the armed men they had supposedly conquered. He had learned something of these people, these Seanchan, in his day and a night on Toman Head, at least as much as the defeated folk knew. It was never hard to find someone alone, and they always answered questions properly put. Men gathered more information on the invaders, as if they actually believed they would eventually do something with what they knew, but they sometimes tried to hold back. Women, by and large, seemed interested in going on with their lives, whoever their rulers were. Yet they noted details men did not, and they talked more quickly once they stopped screaming. Children talked the quickest of all, but they seldom said much that was worthwhile. He had discarded 3/4 of what he had heard as nonsense and rumors growing into fables, but he took some of those conclusions back now. Anyone at all could enter Falma, it appeared. With a start, he saw the truth of a little more nonsense as 20 soldiers rode out of town. He could not make out their mounts clearly, but they were certainly not horses. They ran with a fluid grace, and their dark skins seemed to have a glint in the morning sun, as of scales. He craned his neck to watch them disappear inland, then booted his horse toward the town. The local folk among the stables and parked wagons and fenced horse lots gave him no more than a glance or two. He had no interest in them either. He rode on into the town, onto its cobblestone streets sloping down to the harbor. He could see the harbor clearly, and the large, oddly shaped Shanchan ships anchored there. No one bothered him as he searched streets that were neither crowded nor empty. There were more Shanchan soldiers here. The people hurried about their business with eyes down, bowing whenever soldiers passed, but the Shanchan paid them no mind. It all seemed peaceful on the surface, despite the armored Shanchan in the streets and the ships in the harbor. But Fane could sense the tension underneath. He always did well when men were tense and afraid. He came to a large house with more than a dozen soldiers standing guard before it. Fane stopped and dismounted. Except for one obvious officer, most wore armor of unrelieved black, and their helmets made him think of locusts' heads. Two leathery-skinned beasts with three eyes and horny beaks instead of mouths flanked the front door, squatting like crouching frogs. The soldier standing by each of the creatures had three eyes painted on the breast of his armor. Fane eyed the blue-bordered banner flapping above the roof, the spread-winged hawk clutching lightning bolts, and chortled inside himself. Women went in and out of a house across the street, women linked by silver leashes, but he ignored them. He knew about Damani from the villagers. They might be of some use later, but not now. The soldiers were looking at him, especially the officer, whose armor was all gold and red and green. Forcing an ingratiating smile onto his face, Fane made himself bow deeply. "My lords, I have something here that will interest your great lord. I assure you he will want to see it, and me, personally." He gestured to the square shape on his pack horse, still wrapped in the huge striped blanket in which his people had found it. The officer stared him up and down. "You sound a foreigner to this land. Have you taken the oaths?"
"I obey, await, and will serve," Fane replied smoothly.
Everyone he had questioned spoke of the oaths, though none had understood what they meant. If these people wanted oaths, he was prepared to swear to anything. He had long since lost count of the oaths he had taken. The officer motioned two of his men to see what was under the blanket. Surprised grunts at the weight as they lifted it down from the pack saddle turned to gasps when they stripped the blanket away. The officer stared with no expression on his face at the silver-worked golden chest resting on the cobblestones, then looked at Fane.
"A gift fit for the Empress herself. You will come with me."
One of the soldiers searched Fane roughly, but he endured it in silence, noting that the officer and the two soldiers who took up the chest surrendered their swords and daggers before going inside. Anything he could learn of these people, however small, might help, though he was confident of his plan already. He was always confident, but never more than where lords feared an assassin's knife from their own followers. As they went through the door, the officer frowned at him, and for a moment Fane wondered why.
Of course, the beasts.
Whatever they were certainly no worse than Trollocs, nothing at all beside a Murdrol, and he had not given them a second look. It was too late to pretend to be afraid of them now, but the Shanchan said nothing, only led him deeper into the house. And so Fane found himself on his face in a room bare of furnishings except for folding screens that hid its walls, while the officer told the High Lord Turok of him and his offering. Servants brought a table on which to set the chest so the High Lord would have no need to stoop. All Fane saw of them were scurrying slippers. He bided his time impatiently. Eventually there would come a time when he was not the one to bow. Then the soldiers were dismissed and Fane told to rise. He did so slowly, studying both the High Lord, with his shaven head and his long fingernails and his blue silk robe, brocaded with blossoms, and the man who stood beside him, with the unshaven half of his pale hair in a long braid. Fane was sure the fellow in green was only a servant, however great, but servants could be useful, especially if they stood high in their master's sight.
A marvelous gift.
Jurok's eyes lifted from the chest to Fane. A scent of roses wafted from the High Lord.
Yet the question asks itself, how did one like you come by a chest many lesser lords could not afford? Are you a thief?
Fane tugged at his worn, none too clean coat.
It is sometimes necessary for a man to appear less than he is, High Lord. My present shabbiness allowed me to bring this to you unmolested. This chest is old, High Lord, as old as the Age of Legends, and within it lies a treasure such as few eyes have ever seen. Soon, very soon, High Lord, I will be able to open it and give you that which will enable you to take this land as far as you wish, to the spine of the world, the Aiel Waste, the lands beyond. Nothing will stand against you, High Lord. Once I...
He cut off as Jurok began running his long-nailed fingers over the chest.
I have seen chests such as this, chests from the Age of Legends,
the High Lord said,
though none so fine. They are meant to be opened only by those who know the pattern, but I... Ah.
He pressed among the ornate whorls and bosses. There was a sharp click, and he lifted back the lid. A flicker of what might have been disappointment passed across his face. Fane bit the inside of his lip till blood came to keep from snarling. It lessened his bargaining position that he was not the one who had opened the chest. Still, all the rest could go as he had planned if he could only make himself be patient. But he had been patient so long.
These are treasures from the Age of Legends,
Jurok said, lifting out the curled horn in one hand and the curved dagger with the ruby in its golden hilt in the other. Fane clutched his hands and fists at his sides so he would not grab the dagger.
The Age of Legends,
Jurok repeated softly, tracing the silver script inlaid around the golden bell of the horn with the tip of the dagger's blade. His brows rose in startlement, the first open expression Fane had seen from him, but in the next instant, Turok's face was as smooth as ever.
Do you have any idea what this is?
The Horn of Valir, High Lord, Fane said smoothly, pleased to see the mouth of the man with the braid drop open.
Jurok only nodded as if to himself. The High Lord turned away. Fane blinked and opened his mouth, then, at a sharp gesture from the yellow-haired man, followed without speaking. It was another room with all the original furnishings gone, replaced by folding screens and a single chair facing a tall, round cabinet. Still holding the horn and the dagger, Jurok looked at the cabinet, then away. He said nothing. But the other Shan-Chan snapped quick orders, and in moments, men in plain woolen robes appeared through a door behind the screens, bearing another table. A young woman, with hair so pale it was almost white, came behind them, her arms full of small stands of polished wood in various sizes and shapes. Her garment was white silk and so thin that Fane could see her body clearly through it. But he had eyes only for the dagger. The horn was a means to an end, but the dagger was a part of him. Jurok briefly touched one of the wooden stands the girl held, and she placed it on the center of the table. The men turned the chair to face it under the direction of the man with the braid. The lower servants' hair hung to their shoulders. They scurried out with bows that almost put their heads on their knees. Placing the horn on the stand so that it stood upright, Jurok laid the dagger on the table in front of it and went to sit in the chair. Fane could no longer stand it. He reached for the dagger. The yellow-haired man caught his wrist in a crushing grip.
Unshaven dog! Know that the hand that touches the property of the High Lord unbidden is cut off.
It is mine, Fane growled.
Patience. So long.
Jurok, lounging back in the chair, lifted one blue lacquered fingernail, and Fane was pulled out of the way so the High Lord could view the horn unobstructed.
Yours, Jurok said. Inside a chest you could not open. If you interest me sufficiently, I may give you the dagger. Even if it is from the Age of Legends, I have no interest in such as that. Before all else, you will answer me a question. Why have you brought the Horn of Valir to me?
Fain eyed the dagger longingly a moment more, then jerked his wrist free and rubbed it as he bowed.
That you may sound it, High Lord. Then you may take all of this land, if you wish, all of the world. You may break the White Tower and grind the Aes Sedai to dust, for even their powers cannot stop heroes come back from the dead.
I am to sound it. Turok's tone was flat. And break the White Tower. Again, why? You claim to obey, await, and serve, but this is a land of oathbreakers. Why do you give your land to me? Do you have some private quarrel with these women?
Fain tried to make his voice convincing.
Patient, like a worm boring from within.
My lord, my family has passed down a tradition, generation upon generation. We serve the High King, Artur Peandreg Tanriol, and when he was murdered by the witches of Tarvalin, we did not abandon our oaths. When others warred and tore apart what Artur Hawkwing had made, we held to our swearing and suffered for it, but held to it still. This is our tradition, High Lord. Handed father to son and mother to daughter, down all the years since the High King was murdered. That we await the return of the armies Artur Hawkwing sent across the Arith Ocean. That we await the return of Artur Hawkwing's blood to destroy the White Tower and take back what was the High King's. And when the Hawkwing's blood returns, we will serve and advise as we did for the High King. High Lord, except for its border, the banner that flies over this roof is the banner of Luthair, the son Artur Peandreg Tanriol sent with his armies across the ocean. Fain dropped to his knees, giving a good imitation of being overwhelmed.
High Lord, I wish only to serve and advise the blood of the High King.
Turok was silent so long that Fain began to wonder if he needed further convincing. He was ready with more, as much as was required. Finally, though, the High Lord spoke.
You seem to know what none, neither the high nor low, has spoken since sighting this land. The people here speak it as one rumor among ten, but you know. I can see it in your eyes, hear it in your voice. I can almost think you were sent to entangle me in a trap. But who, possessing the Horn of Elir, would use it so? None of those of the blood who came with the Hylena could have had the horn, for the legend says it was hidden in this land. And surely any lord of this land would use it against me rather than put it in my hands. How did you come to possess the Horn of Elir? Do you claim to be a hero, as in the legend? Have you done valorous deeds?
I am no hero, High Lord.
Fain ventured a self-deprecating smile, but Turok's face did not alter, and he let it go. The horn was found by an ancestor of mine during the turmoil after the king's death. He knew how to open the chest, but that secret died with him in the War of the 100 Years that rent Artur Hawkwing's empire, so that all we who followed him knew was that the horn lay within, and we must keep it safe until the High King's blood returned.
Almost could I believe you.
Believe, High Lord. Once you sound the horn, do not ruin what convincing you have managed to do.
I shall not sound the Horn of Valir. When I return to Shonshan, I shall present it to the Empress as the chiefest of my trophies. Perhaps the Entrist will sound it herself.
But, High Lord, Fain protested, you must!
He found himself lying on his side, his head ringing. Only when his eyes cleared did he see the man with the pale braid, rubbing his knuckles and realize what had happened.
Some words, the fellow said softly, are never used to thy lord.
Fain decided how the man was going to die. Turok looked from Fain to the horn as placidly as if he had seen nothing.
Perhaps I will give you to the Empress along with the Horn of Valir. She might find you amusing, a man who claims his family held true where all others broke their oaths or forgot them.
Fain hid his sudden elation in the act of climbing back to his feet. He had not even known of the existence of an empress until Turok mentioned her. But access to a ruler again, that opened new paths, new plans. Access to a ruler with the might of the Shanchan beneath her and the Horn of Valir in her hands.
Much better than making this Churoc a great king. He could wait for some parts of his plan.
Softly. Mustn't let him know how much you want it. After so long, a little more patience will not hurt.
As the High Lord wishes, he said, trying to sound like a man who only wanted to serve.
You seem almost eager, Turok said,
and Fane barely suppressed a wince.
I will tell you why I will not sound the Horn of Valir or even keep it, and perhaps that will cure your eagerness. I do not wish a gift of mine to offend the Empress by his actions. If your eagerness cannot be cured, it will never be satisfied, for you will never leave these shores. Do you know that whoever blows the Horn of Valir is linked to it thereafter? That so long as he or she lives, it is no more than a horn to any other?
He did not sound as if he expected answers, and in any case, he did not pause for them.
I stand 12th in the line of succession to the Crystal Throne. If I kept the Horn of Valir, all between myself and the throne would think I meant to be first hereafter. And while the Empress, of course, wishes that we contend with one another so that the strongest and most cunning will follow her, she currently favors her second daughter, and she would not look well on any threat to Tuan. If I sounded it, even if I then laid this land at her feet and every woman in the White Tower leashed, the Empress, may she live forever, would surely believe I meant to be more than merely her heir.
Fane stopped himself short of suggesting how possible that would be with the aid of the horn. Something in the High Lord's voice suggested, as hard as Fane found it to believe, that he actually meant his wish for her to live forever.
I must be patient. A worm in the root.
The Empress's listeners may be anywhere,
Turok continued.
They may be anyone. Juan was born and raised in the house of Aladan, and his family for 11 generations before him, yet even he could be a listener.
The man with the braid half made a protesting gesture before jerking himself back to stillness.
Even a High Lord or a High Lady can find their deepest secrets known to listeners, can wake to find themselves already handed over to the seekers for truth. Truth is always difficult to find, but the seekers spare no pain in their search, and they will search as long as they think there is need. They make great efforts not to allow a High Lord or High Lady to die in their care, of course. For no man's hand may slay one in whose veins flows the blood of Otto Hawkwing. If the Empress must order such a death, the unfortunate one is placed alive in a silken bag, and that bag hung over the side of the Tower of the Ravens, and left there until it rots away. No such care would be taken for one such as you. At the Court of the Nine Moons in Shandar, one such as you could be given to the seekers for a shift of your eye, for a misspoken word, for a whim. Are you still eager?
Fane managed a tremble in his knees.
I only wish to serve and advise, High Lord. I know much that may be useful.
This Court of Shandar sounded a place where his plans and skills would find fertile ground.
Until I sail back to Shonchan, you will amuse me with your tales of your family and its tradition. It is a relief to find a second man in this light-forsaken land who can amuse me, even if you both tell lies, as I suspect. You may leave me.
No other word was spoken, but the girl, with the nearly white hair and the almost transparent robe, appeared on quick feet to kneel with downcast head beside the High Lord, offering a single steaming cup on a lacquered tray. High Lord, Fane said. The man with the braid, Juan, took hold of his arm, but he pulled loose. Juan's mouth tightened angrily as Fane made his deepest bow yet.
I will kill him slowly, yes.
High Lord, there are those who follow me. They mean to take the Horn of Valir. Dark friends and worse, High Lord. And they cannot be more than a day or two behind me.
Turok took a sip of black liquid from the thin cup balanced on long-nailed fingertips.
Few dark friends remain in Shonjan.
Those who survive the Seekers for Truth meet the axe of the headsman. It might be amusing to meet a dark friend.
High Lord, they are dangerous. They have Trollocs with them. They are led by one who calls himself Randall Thor. A young man, but vile in the shadow beyond belief, with a lying, devious tongue. In many places he has claimed to be many things, but always the Trollocs come when he is there, High Lord. Always the Trollocs come and kill.
Trollocs, Chirok mused. There were no Trollocs in Shanchan, but the armies of the night had other allies, other things. I've often wondered if a Grom could kill a Trolloc. I will have watch kept for your Trollocs and your dark friends, if they are not another lie. This land wearies me with boredom.
He sighed and inhaled the fumes from his cup. Fain let the grimacing Juan pull him out of the room, hardly even listening to the snarled lecture on what would happen if he ever again failed to leave Lord Turok's presence when given permission to do so. He barely noticed when he was pushed into the street with a coin and instructions to return on the morrow.
Randall Thor was his now. I will see him dead at last, and then the world will pay for what was done to me.
Giggling under his breath, he led his horses down into the town in search of an inn.